You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Democratic bloggers haven't just been taking aim at Republicans these days. They've also been targeting the Democratic Party establishment, which they view as antiquated and ineffective. Now, two of the country's leading bloggers have extended that into what you might call a manifesto in the form of a new book, Crashing the Gate: Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. It's published by Chelsea Green, and it brings Marcos Melitzis of DailyCoast.com and Jerome Armstrong of MyDD.com to my show today. Hello.
Hey there.
Good afternoon.
You write that consultants and Washington insiders deserve a lot of the blame for Democratic defeats. If they're so ineffective, why do these consultants continue to be hired by campaigns around the country? Jerome?
Well, part of the reason is they're part of the institution. They know these candidates really well. They're friends with them. And so they look to them for advice each cycle, and they just turn out the same template every cycle, losing after losing.
Now you single out Bob Schrum, Marcos. Why?
Well, having a 0-8 win-loss record in presidential elections is a good sign. But it's more than that. It's a fact that—
Didn't he work for Bill Clinton?
No, he did not. And in fact, he started working for Jimmy Carter, became disillusioned with the campaign, quit that campaign because he thought it was going nowhere. And that's the one campaign he could have worked that actually would have won.
He's a partner of James Carville and pollster Stan Greenberg, who have worked on winning campaigns, so they must see something in him.
It's all part of this old boys network in D.C. We call it the Beltway Mafia. And they all know each other. And what's really interesting is that the people who run the party are these consultants, and every cycle they just rotate jobs. It's musical chairs. So the people who are running the party are going to make sure that their friends are the people who are going to be working the campaigns.
There's no doubt that at one point they were very effective with what they do, but the thing that they haven't done is they haven't adapted to the changing media landscape and the increasing importance of internet and cable television, the fragmented media. They continue to air the same old television ads on just broadcast television.
And you think the internet is the way to go? In the Dean campaign, many people talked about the effectiveness of the campaign, but it still reaches a rather limited audience.
No, it's true. In terms of campaign size for ad budget, I mean, you're still only looking at about 10% for internet, but that's 10% of the voters out there that you can't ignore. And the same with cable, you know, getting into these small niche cable stations that the Bush campaign did well targeting in 2004, which the Kerry campaign didn't do at all.
Yeah. Yeah, no, one of the things that one of the misconceptions about what we're doing is that we're saying that the internet's going to save the party, the internet's going to save the world, and it's not. You know, the internet is a tool in the whole toolbox. And the fact is that the Democratic Party establishment is misusing every one of the tools in that toolbox, the internet being one of them, on-the-ground organizing, television, and the book really goes through all these different areas, but it's not just the internet.
Well, the internet, at least according to popular wisdom, is mostly for younger people. And younger people are not as involved in politics as they have been at other times. Do you think it's because they're not being approached through the internet, or is it because the world has changed, or younger people perhaps are more conservative, as some others have pointed out?
I think that overall, most people that vote tend to be older. That's a historical trend that hasn't changed. But still, you tend to grab these people at the young age, and they stick with whatever party they identify for generations on later.
How old are you guys?
I'm 42.
34. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually a misconception that people online, that people who read blogs and follow politics online are younger. I've found that on Daily Coast, which gets several hundred thousand visitors a day, the vast majority of my readers are about 40 to 55. So it's actually an older crowd. People who are under the age of 35, only about 30%. Now, I've talked to organizations, labor unions, and they'll say 35%, you know, in our area, in our world, grassroots organizing, there's only about 10% of people under 35. So proportionately, it's a bigger proportion. But if you look at the overall pie, it's actually very well distributed by age.
My guests are Jerome Armstrong of MyDD.com and Marcos Melitzis of DailyCoast.com. They have collaborated on a book called Crashing the Gate: Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. You said that the consultants have tended to be ineffectual. So do you think Democrats should fight fire with fire when it comes to things like attack ads and Texas-style gerrymandering?
Well, in terms of the attack ads, I think where you see the Republicans being more effective is being able to use emotion instead of just trying to persuade them with the facts. They tend to look for more creative things. And the Democratic Party is, in its strategists, they're stuck in D.C. They don't reach out into New York and the media. That's changed and using much more effective strategies that use more pull on emotional things.
Well, right now we're seeing attack ads from the Republican Party attacking Senator Russ Feingold's call for a censure of President Bush for illegal wiretapping. And it really sounds to me like it's quite effective advertising. It suggests that this is absolutely the wrong time to go after the president. It undermines our fight against terrorism, it says.
Yeah, the Republicans a long time ago realized that they needed to reach out to advertising executives outside of D.C., people in Madison Avenue and places like that. And Madison Avenue, when you talk about when Burger King sells a hamburger, they don't sit there up there with a chart, talking about the nutritional information of this hamburger and why you need food to survive and this is why you should choose this hamburger. No, they create a lifestyle. They create feelings. They tug on emotions. And that's what Republicans are very good at, Liberals and Democrats seem to think that, well, if people just know the facts, how many billions are spent here and how many millions are spent there and what our guy can do policy-wise, if we just list off this list of policies and issues that this guy is going to tackle, people are going to go, oh, yeah, I agree with these issues. But it doesn't work that way.
But when Senator Feingold says we should censure the president for illegal wiretapping, that's an emotional thing.
Absolutely.
And
that's
it gets
so
a lot of Democrats motivated, but critics are saying it's creating a backlash that will end up benefiting the president. So is there a catch-22 here?
I haven't actually seen – have you seen numbers that say it's – I saw the recent numbers that came out of Ohio. Bush is still stuck down at 33, 34.
Yeah. It's funny. The people who are claiming this is going to be a big backlash are Republicans that are desperately trying to shut down Russ Feingold. So
Democrats must feel that way too because they're all hiding from this.
Oh, well, this goes to what we're talking about. You have this class of consultants in D.C. who are basically advising Democrats. They're afraid. They've been afraid since Bush was elected in 2000, and they basically rolled over when Republicans essentially stole the election in 2000. And they've been afraid ever since, after 9/11, after Afghanistan, after Iraq, on and on and on. And they've so internalized this notion that Bush is really popular, therefore we cannot attack him, to the point that now that Bush is in the 20s and 30s in most states, they still can't break out of that place. And what we've been arguing a lot is that Democrats need to start offering alternative vision to Republicans and instead of just sitting back and watching the Republican Party implode.
But everybody's been saying this for years. Why don't the Democrats hear it, Jerome?
Well, they just keep on waiting for, it's when
are they waiting for Godot here? Is that
they're they're waiting for the Republicans to lose. It comes down to it. They think sooner or later the country's going to wake up and say, you know what, we don't want to elect these Republicans anymore. Let's try the Democrats.
That sounds like a lousy strategy to me. The last election, most people said that the people who were on the fence said that they voted for the president because he seemed to have a firmer approach to things. The flip-flop thing really worked well against John Kerry.
No, absolutely. I mean, this notion that we're gonna win an election by basically having people vote against Republicans, it's not a really positive agenda for this country. It's not a way to run a party. We should be trying to get people to vote for Democrats because they want to vote for the Democrats, not because they're voting against the Republicans.
Well, there were protest marches last weekend in New York. Hardly anyone showed up and hardly anyone noticed. So have marches become irrelevant?
We think so, pretty much. I mean, I think you could still do marches, but they have to engage the media in the way the format works now. I mean, if you could do things like live blogging and live internet while the march is going on, perhaps you can engage it that way. But if it's not really happening on the media nowadays, then who's watching it?
Yeah, who wants to cover a march? It's boring. There's no storyline to really, really, really latch onto. So,
but people didn't even go. In India recently, in protest for a court decision, people were all responded to a radio request, I think it was, through their cell phones and their BlackBerries, and 100,000 people or more showed up for a protest.
Amazing.
Yeah, but the story there is almost as kind of using the BlackBerries and the cell phones to organize. I mean, that almost makes it a lot more interesting than putting up a bunch of flyers on a street post and hoping that people will show up.
So you think that that would have been a better way for people to have organized this march?
I think it's, you're probably looking at a cultural situation there, because also in East Asia, they've had mass things happen, you know, through text messaging and stuff like that. I think we organize a little bit differently here in the States than we do out there.
But I mean, I think the thing to remember here is that the world has changed. I mean, the media landscape has changed dramatically with the internet and satellite television, satellite radio, and the political landscape has changed dramatically. It's more partisan, vicious Republican machine, and we're not adapting. And so thinking that protests, which were very effective back in the 60s and 70s, somehow are still relevant 30 years later, 40 years later, it really doesn't take into account how things have changed. And it's all about media now. It's how do you reach people? And you look at the jib-jab flash animation during the last election, and that was passed around to millions of people. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that now really grabs people's attention and can be very effective.
You're right about how Democrats are a party of fragmented interest groups, but aren't Republicans equally fragmented? How do they manage to stick together when it really counts?
Well, they were really hungry for a lot of years out in the wilderness, and they just got to the point where they stuck all their differences aside. Look, it's more important that we win as a movement for the conservative movement than to push our individual agenda ahead of all the others.
And the Democrats haven't been out in the wilderness now for long enough?
We're hoping we have.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. We were in Texas, and we were meeting with a bunch of interest groups, issue groups, all the usual suspects, environmental, women's groups, and
we were
labor.
Like, oh, boy.
And we thought we were going to get a tongue lashing from these people, right? But they agreed at this meeting that they were going to start working together, share their membership lists, and I was shocked. I thought maybe they're just playing nice because they're in a room together. But actually, they were really serious. And one participant in this meeting said, you know, at this point, what do we have to lose? And I think that's where we are now. And that's where the Republicans were when they realized that they had to put their differences aside. And I think that's where we are now.
At least the Democrats are in Texas.
They're
pretty far down.
We'll see the rest of the country.
Although Texas, I predict, will go solidly Republican in the upcoming elections and in future elections for quite a while. Now, when Republicans do attack ads, it seems to be very effective. We saw them really work well against John Kerry, for example, and against other people, Vietnam War vets who had lost their arms and legs. And yet when Howard Dean criticized Republicans forcefully, he was described as a guy who was out of control. So yeah. Is there a catch-22 here?
By some in his own party as well. There's no doubt that people can do effective ads on the Democratic side. One of the ones that we talk about in the book was in the 4th District of Colorado, Marilyn Musgrave. And the effectiveness of those ads brought her numbers tumbling down. But even within the Democratic Party, people criticized them because they thought they were too vicious.
Yeah, the ad was a soldier in Iraq in a combat zone, and the Marilyn Musgrave lookalike sneaks up behind him and picks his pocket. So basically, this congresswoman is taking money from her fighting men and women. And it was very, very, I mean, emotionally, it was very, very kind of slaps you in the face type of advertisement. And so you saw these Democrats rushing to denounce this ad as over the top, when in fact it actually was brutally effective in bringing down their numbers.
We have to take a little break here. We'll talk about some other campaigns, one, the Montana miracle, so-called, and also what's happened in Rhode Island and other things as we continue this conversation with Jerome Armstrong and Marcos Moulitsas, who is on the cover of the book, Marcos Moulitsas Zuniga, and maybe we'll even talk about that. Their book, Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics, is published by Chelsea Green. Stay with us. We're back with Jerome Armstrong, who began his first political blog, mydd.com, in 2001. He is an architect of the Netroots strategy that used blogs and meetups for Howard Dean's campaign. And Marcos Moulitsas, who served in the U.S. Army for 3 years, later earned 2 bachelor degrees, a law degree, and then created DailyCos.com in 2002, and he now gets more than 1 million visitors each day, almost as many people as listen to this show on any given moment. They have collaborated on a book called Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. It is published by Chelsea Green. A listener called in to talk about the switcher ads that Errol Morris tried to do for John Kerry, and that were totally ignored by the Kerry campaign. James Carville has talked about how the Kerry campaign listened to focus groups who said they were tired of negative advertising, and as a result did the blandest ads possible, and also allowed John Kerry to be attacked for quite a while in terms of his bravery in Vietnam before he finally responded to the Swift Boat campaign against him. So what's going to happen? Do you see a change in the next presidential election? Have the Democrats learned something from that experience?
Well, in terms of, I mean, focus groups are really the bane of our existence. Here you get consultants that get 12 people in the room to tell them what they should do politically, and when these guys should know already. It's what they get paid for. But in terms of, you know, are things going to change for 2006? In terms of the media and how the campaigns are going to run, I don't think so yet. I think we're still looking at business as usual.
And how do you blame the media?
Well, the media in terms of what the Democratic candidates are going to run, they're going to run television commercials pretty much with 90% of their media budget and targeted towards broadcast television over ABC, CBS, and NBC. And that's not where the viewers are.
Where are they?
Well,
some of them are at Fox, but those ads would not be effective on Fox.
It's very difficult to reach people now through advertising, and they keep on. We're throwing more and more money at it and reaching less and less people. Things like DVR, people are tuning out completely. The younger generation, they're on things like IM and MySpace and iPods. They don't even get media commercials.
So how do you reach people?
Well, one of the things that Republicans are very good at is they segment out their intended target audiences. So they know how to reach them. So for the religious base, they can reach them on the 700 Club. For their soccer moms, they'll go to Bill O'Reilly and Fox News. And one of the things that we see with these 500 channels in satellite television is that in satellite radio, that there's very segmented audiences in affinity groups. So car lovers are in certain stations and country music fans are in certain stations. They know how to reach them exactly where their voters are. And while Democrats are still going to the broadcast networks and they're trying to get kind of like it's the biggest audience, but this is a very diffused audience, not necessarily the kind of people that may want to vote Democratic.
They've spent the last couple cycles, the Republicans have, investing tens of million dollars into researching and fine-tuning their database so that they know the particulars of about everybody. They don't only go to their strongholds in the rural counties. They go into the urban areas and find those 25% of people that are going to vote Republican and target them. We don't do that on our side.
Can you talk about the Montana miracle of 2004? What happened there?
Well, what happened there was that they did go out into the rural areas, or Democrats did. They ran candidates all across the state. And we talk about John Tester, who won in a dominant Republican area by just going door to door and, you know, meeting the people. And this was the case where the Democrats ran as a team all across the state in Montana, and they won.
Now, the thing that's dramatic about them winning is that same year that Bush carried Montana 59% to 39% carry. Democrats picked up 4 or 5 statewide offices, including the governorship. They took over both the state Senate and the state House. So it was a huge tidal wave year for local Montana Democrats, even while Kerry was being blown out of the water nationally.
Which would muddy the waters when we talk about red state, blue state.
Absolutely. I mean, this red state, blue state divide is actually not as clean as people would like it to be.
What's the story behind Jim Langevin's Senate bid in Rhode Island?
You want me to cover that? Yeah. Jim Langevin is a congressman in Rhode Island, and he is without a doubt the most popular politician in the state. So he was considering running for Senate against Lincoln Chafee. Lincoln Chafee is a Republican senator in the most Democratic state in the country.
But the most liberal of all the Republican senators.
Yes, he is, but of course that's relative. I mean, he still votes with Republicans a lot more than he votes with Democrats. And so Republicans have been very effective at making sure that there are very few Democrats left in red states all across the South. And so he was a national target, right? Chafee does not support the people of Rhode Island politically. So Langevin was going to run, but Langevin is also Catholic and is very much anti-choice, which, you know, I'm pro-choice, Jerome's pro-choice. It's, you know, it's not that kind of thing we celebrate, but fact is that on every other issue, he would have won. And he would have, had he won, you know, if we took back the Senate, the Democrats took back the Senate, anti-choice legislation would not see the light of day. And with Lincoln Chafee, he's supporting a party that is very virulently anti-choice.
So what happened?
Well, when it comes down to it, Chafee is going to vote for Frist as majority leader in the Senate. And that's really what decides a lot of the agenda there.
So what happened is that the women's groups, National Organization of Women, and they are all geared up and essentially pushed him out of the race. And because of that issue. So what we're seeing is that the broader picture, they actually hurt their broader cause because a Democratic Senate would be much more friendly to them than Lincoln Chafee.
Abortion and gun control are two big issues that hurt Democrats in many parts of the country. But how do you get around something like that if you believe that choice is something that should be supported, if you believe that gun control is something that's necessary because of all the gun deaths in this country? What do? Just change your position to get more votes?
No, what we argue is that the various issue groups have a duty to their members and to their board of directors to support their issue. That's what they exist to do. So what we're saying is there are plenty of candidates out there for each one of these organizations to get behind and support that are friendly to their agenda, but not to actively oppose and work against those Democrats that do not meet that litmus test. And we saw this in Colorado, actually. They were very, very effective in Colorado. The issue groups came together, and they created two organizations, one of them that would support local candidates, local as in state Colorado, state legislature candidates, who were kind of they met the whole litmus test of progressive issues, and then they created another organization for those who weren't perfect on labor or the environment or choice or on and on. And so organizations didn't have to put their money behind those candidates that didn't meet their agenda, but they were still working together, and it was a huge success. Colorado was the other state, along with Montana, that saw huge gains at the state level for the Democratic Party. They took over both the Senate and the House, even though they were very far behind in the House. And in a state that Bush ended up carrying.
Talking to two of the most popular bloggers supporting the Democratic Party's cause, Jerome Armstrong and Marcos Melitzas, and they have collaborated on a book called Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics, published by Chelsea Green. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. You're competing bloggers, aren't you? How did you wind up collaborating on a book?
I started blogging in 2001 early on, and Marcos was one of the first readers early 2002. He started emailing back and forth. And he started a blog shortly thereafter. And I think in blogging, it's much more collaborative between sites. You have a lot more linking back and forth. You'll read on their ideas and kind of feed off them. So I don't really see it as competitive, more collaborative.
You also read Republican bloggers?
Yeah, I mean,
Not too much.
It's pretty painful, so I avoid it as much as possible. But you know, sometimes you just can't help it.
Marcos, you served in the U.S. military for 3 years. Did that experience shape your political views?
Absolutely. I actually entered the Army as a Republican. I was young. I was 17. I didn't know better. And I got out as a Democrat. And there's this big perception that the military is very much a conservative outfit. But I served with people from all over the country, all different socioeconomic status levels. And the military is actually a very socialized world. I mean, they took care of my food. They took care of my housing. I had free health care. And it was an environment where we were all taught to look out for each other. We were working as a team. And then to go out in the real world, quote unquote, where you have these Republicans saying everybody's out on their own, we're not going to take care of everybody or anybody, that really rubbed me the wrong way, and I became a Democrat.
Why do you think so many Iraq war vets are going into the Democratic Party? Whenever we see interviews with people in Iraq, they all seem to be strongly in support of the effort.
I think there's a recent poll out that showed a plurality was actually against the continuance of it there mm-hmm. past a year. So it's actually, I think, that the polls have turned in that sense. And the people that are the soldiers that are on the ground there realize the futility of it.
Yeah, not only that, but they also see the veterans benefits are being cut by this administration. Their pay is being not cut, but you know it's not keeping pace with inflation, and so there is no way that they can blame Democrats because Democrats are out of power. I mean, they know exactly who's at fault, and it's a Republican leadership both in the White House and in Congress.
The blogosphere rallied around the Iraq War veteran Paul Hackett in his bid for a congressional seat in Ohio. What made him so attractive to grassroots Democrats?
There's two strains that are really, I mean, you have the sort of the ideological bent where we're progressive and we go for progressive causes, but there's also a strong partisan strain out there that's attractive to people that are in the blogosphere, and I think Paul Hackett tapped into that really strongly.
Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, it was the partisanship, but it was a very Republican district, and the consultants in D.C. would say, you can't criticize the president, you can't criticize the war, because this is a very red district outside of Cincinnati. And
well, the other candidate seems to be equally liberal and perhaps even a bit more liberal, the guy who they backed.
Are you talking about the Ohio Senate race now?
Oh, you're talking about the prior—oh, we were talking about the congressional.
Yeah, we're talking about
the congressional. Yeah, that's actually—that reflects this, you know, the split I was talking about earlier. You have Brown, who's very ideologically progressive, and Hackett, who is very partisan Democrat. So you kind of had this battle within the Netroots of who was, you know, who they wanted to support.
But there's this perception that liberal bloggers are these far-left extremist crazies. When in fact, we just want Democrats to talk like Democrats. And Paul Hackett was really attractive because he was in a very conservative district. The party wasn't paying any attention to him, so they didn't send the consultants in to muzzle him. So he could be the kind of person we've been arguing would play well in these red states, somebody who was not afraid of the Republicans, of Bush. And he was very, very vicious in his criticisms of Bush and the Republicans, and yet he almost won.
Jerome, you're currently working as a political consultant for former Virginia Governor Mark Warner, aren't you?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is this how you're making a living? Because I can't imagine you make a lot of money from running a blog.
No, although we do pretty good with the blog. I have four people that shared the blog ad revenues from blogging. But partly, yeah, consulting with the different candidates that I've worked with.
Aren't his politics to the right of somebody like Russ Feingold?
I don't think there's a... I mean, the comparison there is that this is Mark Warner as his governor term. I think if you look at what he's done while he's been in governor, he's been very progressive in terms of education, the environment, and the economy.
Yeah, I do very well as a full-time blogger, so some of us actually can make
what
a
do
living.
You make money on advertising? What do you make money
advertising,
on?
Yes. And it's great because I'm beholden to nobody. I can write whatever I want without being afraid of somebody trying to muzzle me. It's a pretty liberating experience.
And what happens if you want to take a vacation? Ask Matt Drudge to take over while you go.
I have a team of supporting cast, called contributing editors, who actually keep the site going when I'm on the road and doing things like this.
The blogs are very much community sites. So there's a number of people that can post on the front page and on the diaries, and so it's quite a community interactiveness. So even if we're gone, it runs on its own.
I want to talk a bit more about grassroots activism, because whenever we discuss how to be effective politically, we get back to the grassroots thing. The environmental lobby is well-funded and has a lot of grassroots support, but you write that it rarely seems to influence policymakers in Washington. Why is that?
Well, part of it is because we're no longer the governing party, and they're used to influencing it with a governing party over on the Hill that they can lobby with, but the Republicans don't allow them any space at all to lobby.
So the Sierra Club or Greenpeace comes to Washington, and they just can't get into the offices of
well, they get into the office
in
of the Democratic. They get into the offices of the Democratic politicians, but they're no longer at the table, you know, and that's why we have to really come together to win again, and they keep on, you know, using the same strategy and tactics as if we were the governing party when we're now really the opposition.
Yeah, it was a much different political landscape back in the 70s, too. I mean, it's hard to believe now, but the EPA was actually created by Nixon, Republican administration. It was a world where parties were they would look across the aisle, and they would negotiate. And they would compromise on some of these issues. And now we have a regime in D.C., this Republican cabal, essentially, that completely has shut out anything that doesn't meet its ideological filters. And the environmentalists are out. The choice groups are out. The women groups are out. All these groups that are used to, we'll compromise on this issue. That doesn't happen anymore in D.C.
Well, there'll have to be a compromise in Pennsylvania where we have Casey facing Santorum and... they both are strong supporters. They're both opposed to abortion very strongly.
I don't know what the compromise is. I mean, they're Democrats. I mean,
well, people are going to have to vote for those candidates, even if they have a different position.
Casey's one of the most popular, if not the most popular, politician in the state of Pennsylvania. So a senator's job, a congressman's job, a politician's job is to represent his or her constituents. And Casey obviously attracts great interest from the people of Pennsylvania. It's not for me to say who they should be represented by. You know, you got to trust them to make the right decision.
James Carville and Paul Begala were on the show a couple of months back, and they seem to share many of your views. They They're critical of using focus groups to craft the party platform. They believe that on issues like gun control and abortion, Democrats have to find more nuanced approaches. But they also would represent the kind of insider consultants that you criticize in the book.
Well, it's not even about finding more nuanced positions on things like guns and the issue of choice. I mean, one of the examples that we recount in the book is during Newt Gingrich's rise, right before the 1994 elections when they came up with the contract with America, Ralph Reed was running the Christian Coalition at the time, walks in the office and says, I want one of those 10. Give me one of those 10 item points in the contract for America. And Newt Gingrich told them, you know what, your agenda doesn't really, I don't know if it didn't poll well, or I'm sure they polled it, right? So we're not going to really let you do that. But you know what, if we win, you'll be taken care of. Don't worry, we'll take care of you if we win. So there's this notion that, you know what, we believe in your agenda and we're going to push your agenda, but we're just not going to make a big public stink about it. And I think that's something that our groups need to learn a lot of times, that it's not necessarily let's surrender or let's give up on the issue of choice or let's, because I don't believe that at all. I would be very much opposed to that. The issue is sometimes we just don't need to talk about it. Let's just let it go.
President Clinton was roughed up in the blogosphere by bloggers like Matt Drudge. How do you think he'd be treated today? And do you think his ability to bring Democrats together compensated for the fact that he wasn't particularly progressive?
Well, the fault that we find with President Clinton, I think you would still find that today if he were still president, if this wasn't happening. And it goes to the criticism of Begala and Carville as well, is that we believe the power resides outside of D.C. When you say people powered politics, we're talking about locations all across America that can organize and fight for the Democratic agenda. Instead of the message and strategies and tactics coming out of D.C., we're going to decentralize and let it come from all over the states.
My guests have been Jerome Armstrong and Marcos Melitzis Zuniga. Their book, Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics, published by Chelsea Green. And you can also read them on a regular basis at their blogs. Marcus's is dailycoast.com, and Jerome's is mydd.com. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.